You are listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain, BC. This radio is diverse, independent, and always yours. Check us out at cjsf.ca or search CJSF 90.1 FM on SoundCloud.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in conversation with Michael Toms. New Dimensions and our quarter-hour New Dimensions Cafe programs are now available worldwide as podcasts. You can find them at the iTunes Store and on many podcast sites and mobile apps. You can also find our podcasts and much more on our website, newdimensions.org. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Willis Barnstone is a poet, translator, biblical scholar, literary critic, memoirist, anthologist, teacher, and painter. If we are to grasp his great contribution to culture over the course of his professional life, we could focus on his role first and foremost as a poet, a lover of sacred words. Willis Barnstone is former O'Connor Professor of Greek at Colgate University, Distinguished Professor of Comparative Literature at Indiana University, a Guggenheim Fellow, and winner of numerous literary awards, including the Emily Dickinson Award, the Lannan and W.H. Auden Awards. He is a prolific translator of the Greek lyric poets, a new historical version of the New Testament, and poets as diverse as Sappho, Rilke, Borges, Machado, Wang Wei, and John of the Cross. At last count, Willis Barnstone's life work amounts to over 75 books, and yet there are several more emerging from his protean imagination in 2015 alone. To read his bibliography is like reading the card catalog from the ancient Alexandrian library. His past works include With Borges on an Ordinary Evening in Buenos Aires, The Politics of Ecstasy from Sappho to Borges, The Poetics of Translation, The Apocalypse, The Gnostic Bible, A Book of Women Poets from Antiquity to Now with his daughter Aliki Barnstone. New works include The Poems of Jesus, The Poets of the Bible, and next year, Mexico in My Heart. Join us for the next hour as we explore the protean imagination of Willis Barnstone. I am Phil Cousineau. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Willis, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Yes. Last fall, I found myself in a weaving factory outside of Rumi's hometown, Konya, in Turkey. Mm-hmm. And I remember being dazzled by how many threads the weavers could keep track of as they wove those gorgeous Turkish carpets. I had that image in mind while I was reviewing your work for this interview. And the overlap was the amount of threads that the weavers have to keep track of. And I'm wondering if that's an image for you with all of the work you're doing in memoir, translation, poetry. Mm-hmm. Are there many threads, or is there one thread that goes through all of your work?
Yes, I think there is. And I think it's the poetic word, or I'd like to think the poetic word is perhaps a synonym for the philosophical word, the metaphysical word, the mystical word, the secular word, anything you can fill that abstraction with, especially things rather than abstractions.
What I find extraordinary about your career is what we might call a kind of binocular vision. You're seeing the world through your own eye, writing your own work, your essays, your criticism, your poetry. And yet you seem to always have your mind on other writers. I love one line you have where you write, I wear a wedding band, reading in gold, do not forget the ancients. What do you mean by that arresting phrase?
Gosh, I don't remember it at all, but I'm very happy to have it attributed to my thought at one point. I remember that Auden said, if we forget the past, I guess many people did, we have a bleak future. The poets of the past and today and the future are my best friends. We talk. I don't mean in a mysterious way. I feel we're close. I'd love to speak to them in reality, but just the fact that they're there, I keep rereading them. They change all the time because our eyes change when we read. And I think we'd hit it fine. I love to go out on a date with Sappho, for example.
Would you mind reading something from your own work right now?
Yes, I'll do so. Here's a poem called The Good Beasts. On the first morning of the moon, in land under the birds of Ur, before the flood dirties the memory of a couple banned from apples and the fatal fire of blood, Adam and Eve walk in the ghetto park, circling a tree. They do not know the way to make their bodies shiver in the spark of fusion, cannot read or talk, and they know night and noon, but not the enduring night of nights that has no noon. Adam and Eve, good beasts, live the morning of the globe, are blind like us to apocalypse. They probe the sun, death ray, on the red tree. Its light rages, illiterate, until they leave.
You could have written down some of those thoughts in prose, but you didn't. You wrote it in verse.
Yes.
What's the difference?
Nothing. We overhear our thoughts when we write. Sometimes, as the Chinese say, we overhear them formally. Otherwise, we don't. The difference between that and most prose is that it's more carefully chosen. It's more metaphorical. I prefer to let a thing represent an idea than an idea represent a thing.
Do you recommend that people in ordinary life read poetry?
I could say something dire and say if they don't, they'll perish. But it's true today. Everybody listens to their earphones hearing poetry, rather old-fashioned rhyming ones, all day long. They have no clue whatsoever what poetry is or that they're listening to it. But poetry keeps them going. Poetry is creation. Poetry is a focus. Poetry is a concentration. But I love fiction. I love many things.
Well, I love the notion that the word itself, being a word hound,
yes,
loving word origins, comes from poesis, which simply means to make in Greek.
To make, right? Yes.
There's something so elemental about,
yes,
that. When we write a poem, we're making something. We're crafting something that didn't actually exist 5 minutes ago.
Yes. Well, it's true to make, to, in the first thing that was made was the universe with the word, let's make light. And so with two words, and it was the best poem in the world, let there be light. It's only two words in Hebrew. It's beautiful, the notion of creation, but we tend to make it a little soupy, but for me, it never is soupy. It's always true. It is so deathly possible for me to go into a creative mood, I have to stop it so I can eat or do something else.
Well, it is life.
It is for me, it's life, yeah.
I believe it was Descartes who said, reading is like talking to men of other centuries. And that's how I have felt reviewing some of your work, the vast amount, not only of your own poetry output, but the range of people that you've translated.
Yes.
How do you put yourself into a mood to translate 1 year in Spanish with Machado, another year the German with Rilke? Do you have to set
I'm a kind of monkey. I always knew I was. My mother liked monkeys, and I became one, I guess, because of her. I have a good ear for languages. I pick up accents quite natively. In that sense, I'm childlike, pre-adolescent, you might say. And I have a book, which I hope will come out, of about 150 pages, in the voice of other poets. So I'm able to be a mimic in that sense. And it gives me tremendous opening of the mind not to be myself. And there is no self. It keeps, you know, if you put yourself in a pound of light, you can't put it together. No, self is always moving and changing. And I'm very happy to be Mr. Change rather than Mr. Still.
There's something else that I detect in your work as well.
Yes.
And it's this deep respect for the sanctity of words, language, getting words and names right.
Yes.
So when I read recently your new book, The Poems of Jesus, of course, the title is striking.
Yeah.
I, like most people, hadn't thought of him as a poet. And yet when I read the introduction to the book, I see that you feel that we misread and misheard the New Testament all of these centuries, and you seem to have felt deeply compelled to finally get it right. Why?
Yes. Well, because we're crazy. We're so partisan when we read anything which is scripture that we lose our eyesight. I mean, if you believe in Jesus, it doesn't really matter one way or the other, whether he's a combinatory person or whenever, but the texts are there. And the text mainly derived from the Hebrew Bible. He only spoke in wisdom verse. There's virtually nothing attributed to him which is not wisdom verse. And so he is one of the great poets. I did leave out the angry, the militant Jesus because it pissed me off, or pisses me off, I should say more correctly. But he's one of the great poets, and so is Isaiah, so is Paul, so is the anonymous John of Patmos who gave us the Apocalypse, that is the book of Revelation, which is the epic poem of the world.
In that book, the Poems of Jesus, you have an extremely arresting line for me, that you wanted to wipe away the trappings of prose and reveal the text to be stunning gospel poetry.
Yes.
Can you expand on that?
Well, you see, all the poets, prose was a very late invention. All early writing was in verse. Probably because it came in song, you can memorize verse more easily than prose. And in the old days, any scripture in any religion was chanted. Nothing was read. And usually memorized because most of the time the chanters were illiterate and passed on. But yes, prose is a question of topography, as Borges said.
Marvelous. I'm speaking with Willis Barnstone, poet, religious scholar, editor extraordinaire. He has published such classics as Ancient Greek Lyrics and With Borges on An Ordinary Evening in Buenos Aires. If you'd like to connect with Willis or learn more about his work, you can go to Willis Barnstone at willisbarnstone.org, or you can find out more about him through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I am Phil Cousineau. You are listening to New Dimensions Radio. I'm speaking with Willis Barnstone, author of innumerable books, including many memoirs such as With Borges on an Ordinary Evening in Buenos Aires. Willis, I love a quote of yours from your ABC of Translation in which you write, "Good translation is as essential to a hungry reader in a decent bookstore in our global village." I was thinking of that and mulling over the word translation, and again, loving word origins, going back to this notion that during the Middle Ages, translation actually referred to the tradition of trading relics.
Oh?
If a cathedral was built, it was required by church tradition to have a relic. So in the age of cathedral building, as they were rising all across the continent, there was suddenly a marketplace for relics.
Yes.
And that meant people stepped into that breach.
Yes.
And they began to trade relics from one country, one diocese to another. Yeah. And that was called translation.
Of course.
Carrying across.
Over. Yeah, yeah.
Carrying over. That's the notion of it.
Mm-hmm.
And metaphorically, that's how I'm thinking of your works as well, carrying the relics of words, fossilized language, as Emerson once described poetry, across one border and also from one time to the other.
Yes.
How does that feel to you as an image?
Well, I like it. Metaphor is the Greek word for translate, metaphoros, metaphora. And it's... when I got to Greece for the first time in 1949, and I saw that sea, and I couldn't believe it. I woke at dawn. It was stormy off the coast of the Peloponnesus. And I looked, and I looked, and it seemed like the inside of a purple grape. And then I realized that Homer had talked about the wine blue sea a while ago. And I saw the coast, and Greece was poor, 10 years of war. And the Germans had starved the country, taking all the foods for their armies. People, 13% of the people died of starvation, but they were now coming back, and there were motorcycles pulling trucks, and each of them had the word metaphora, meaning moving. That was the word for not moving relics, but moving anything you wanted. I said, to come to a country where metaphor is the basic wallboard of the world, who can fail here?
And did you begin translating then?
No. Someone wrote a master's thesis on the things I didn't do once. I was very flattered. And that person also included things that Merwin didn't do. But it was, no, I had once translated a poem by Antonio Machado as an undergraduate at Bowdoin College in Maine. And where, by the way, I wrote my first poem one midnight, after midnight, in the middle of a snowy night, and had no idea I would be a poet for life until I wrote it. Came down the next day, and I fortunately had good friends, a Dane, a Czech, and a Frenchman who told me ideas that made me drunk with vanity, and I've never stopped.
Have you noticed the name of the new subway system in Athens?
What is it called?
Metaphoros.
Oh, right. that's good.
Again, getting carried away. That's the notion. Yeah. You're moving from one corner of Athens
of
to the
course.
Other. You're being carried. In language, we're being carried by metaphor. As a translator, we have to often find not just the literal meaning of the words, but the metaphor. You've also written an ABC of translation, something quite intimate. I'm charmed by this notion. Translation is friendship between two poets, an intimate union that demands love, art, and working with a foreign word. No François Villon's song in French and the cello of his ballad will haunt you for life.
That's absolutely true. I didn't make up because I must have read that from Eternal Scripture someplace. Yes, it's absolutely true.
Why haunt?
When I was doing my book on Antonio Machado, the translation and study, I asked John Dos Passos if he could write an introduction, which he did. And he wrote a beautiful thing, which I've never forgotten. He said, you know, when you go to a country, the best way to learn the language is to get a bag of songs or poems. They're shorter. You can learn them more quickly, and you'll never forget them. And I think that's a way of not only understanding the people, but being able to speak as they think and sing. Nothing is better than that. Now, I can't remember why I'm saying this.
We're talking about the urge for you to translate, but also let's keep moving with that, keep segueing into one of the things that gives me hope in our benighted times, and that is the surge in translation. If I'm not mistaken, there is more translation happening now than any time in human history. More languages, more poetry, pieces of history, memoirs, biography. Yes. And that suggests that maybe we won't demonize people who we don't understand if we can read more from them, from their own hearts and souls.
I have very negative feelings about most translations, alas. But because in the end, we spend a lot of time badly translating things. You don't have to be a poet in your own right. Robert Fitzgerald, I think, was the best translator in the 20th century. He wasn't a first-rate poet, but he was supreme poet when he translated. And I think that unless one has the secrets of beauty, unless something sings, which is also part of the original, otherwise we wouldn't bother. You have to be faithful to the quality of the quality of quality, if I can be redundant. And I feel that's frequently not done, especially in translating poetry. Either they go too far and totally recreate it, which is okay if you're Robert Lowell and doing an imitation, because he does it marvelously. But I do believe it should be a love pact in which both people speak and both people are poets talking to each other.
How important is it for people to branch out from their own neighborhood, so to speak, neighborhood of language, and read people of other times and other cultures?
Well, it is for many, many reasons. For your own salvation, you're not caught in one personality. We are many people, and I know when I think in modern Greek, when I think in French, when I think in Spanish, I'm a very different person. And even when I used to speak bad Chinese, always with a dictionary in one hand, I had a very different personality. So it's the most broadening thing we can do to make us, as Wendell Willkie would say, one world.
Global citizens of some kind.
Yeah.
There's translation, and then there's also restoration or revision. What was the impulse for you into providing for us a Gnostic? How different is it for us to have these texts, which you were writing, gives a primacy to knowledge and personal experience?
Well, I always have been very fond of the Gnostics. First of all, having been exposed to the Quakers, who were into light, L-I-G-H-T, and the notion that we have an inner spark, all of this is pure Quakerism. And you may not find an external God, but you can maybe find salvation in the mind, and then you connect worldly with all light in the world. I found that marvelous. And I also love the Gnostics because Eve is our hero rather than our villain. Eve gave us knowledge. Gnosis, Gnostic, means knowledge. And unfortunately, in most religions, knowledge is the enemy rather than the friend. It happened in the Hebrew Bible. It happens in the Christian Bible. It happens in all Bible. You're supposed to have faith, not knowledge. The Gnostics believe you should know. That's good.
Is knowledge opposed to faith?
That's another question which I think I have an opinion on. But you see, if you use faith to mean this is the truth and so forth and so on, but usually faith and knowledge are deadly enemies. And that is the problem with most religions, that there is an animosity between what appears to be true and what you believe should be true.
At the risk of a bad pun, was there a Genesis moment for you reading the Gnostic work in which you felt inspired to actually dedicate a great deal of time to translating for us or restoring?
I don't know. I guess it was all kind of silly, but I undertake things usually that I know nothing about. And I was in New York, and I had some kind of a NAEH fellowship, and I knew that there was something between the Old Testament and the New Testament. We actually have thousands of pages. We call them intertestamental scripture or pseudepigrapha, technical words. And I knew it existed, but didn't know much about it because I'm almost autistically an amateur at everything. And so I went to the Brooklyn Library and did about an afternoon's research. I came up with the title The Other Bible, sold it in one afternoon to three major publishers. And, I mean, a friend of mine at Bantam Books put the word out. And then half of it was Gnostic. And at that point, because of who knows why, I had that. And then when I read about the Gnostic scriptures and the Gospel of Judas, which, they made a big fuss when the Gospel of Judas came out. But Borges knew all about that. In the 1950s, he had the three ways of Judas, that Judas was the only person who Jesus believed in. And we know, not because we had the original Gospel of Judas, but because Augustine and Irenaeus and other church fathers had written in criticizing it abundantly about it and gave us all the information we found when we found the original texts, which we did about 10 years ago. And my colleague, with whom I did five books, actually, of Gnosticism, Marvin Meyer, who alas died of melanoma a few years ago, much younger than I am, he was the main translator of that book, The Gospel of Judas. Number one bestseller, helped by being put on the Vatican immediately, but on the index, yes.
I'm speaking with poet translator, religious scholar, and religious gadfly, Willis Barnstone, author of dozens of books, including most recently the Gnostic Bible, the Restored New Testament, and the Poems of Jesus. If you would like to connect with Willis Barnstone or know more about his work, you can go to his website, willisbarnstone.org, or you can find out more about him through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. I am Phil Cousineau, and you're listening to New Dimensions.
New Dimensions is brought to you by Friends of New Dimensions membership support and by Larson Publications, publisher of the book An Open Life, Joseph Campbell in Conversation with Michael Toms.